Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Welcome, my wonderful audience. As always, I'm so glad you're with us. Today I have from Australia a truly brave doctor, a courageous physician, Eamon Matheson. He's, I understand, an anesthesiologist. I think he's a lot like many of us in America. I'm a psychiatrist. Some of the folks are cardiologists. Some of us are family doctors who have looked at COVID-19 and said, this is crazy. We have to get involved. We have to put some sound medical sense into what's going on. And we have to remember that we're free people. We're supposed to be a free people, and our freedom's being taken away. Eamon is in Melbourne, Australia, which has been famous here in America. Our impression is it's maybe one of the most closed down cities in the world, maybe one of the worst governances we've seen. I'd love for you to introduce yourself. I can't tell you how pleased I am to have you on. It's really a privilege. And introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about how you got started and what in the world's been happening. And then I'll try to integrate it a little bit into what's going on here.
Sure. Thanks, Peter. Thanks for having me on. And it's great to be able to talk about our experience here in Melbourne, which, as you say, has been quite extreme by world standards. As you say, I'm an anaesthetist and took a particular interest early last year about what was going on. The anaesthetists and operating theatres tended to be considered to be in the front line of the COVID phenomenon. There was a lot of PPE talk about airways and how to avoid the COVID, the SARS-CoV-2 virus in the operating theatre. So there was a lot of concern and angst and anxiety about this amongst my colleagues. And when we first heard things happening in, Wuhan and then in Italy and in other places. So the thing that got me interested, it took me several months and looking closely at the numbers, even of what was happening in Italy and in Wuhan, and comparing it initially to influenza numbers. And I took a long time going through this, asking my colleagues about what was going on. Why was this so different in terms of numbers, even in terms of mortality, hospitalizations, getting the data, the standard data that was coming out of Johns Hopkins and other places, world data, et cetera. And I couldn't really get my head around it. It just seemed to be really strange, but it seemed to be that I was one of the very few people questioning the story or the narrative and the level of fear that was coming out. And I was tracking it, through all of the Sentinel networks and the data information that was coming out of Australia, and kept writing to my colleagues and asking them, can you explain this to me? Because I didn't really know. I just thought I was the odd one out that didn't quite understand what was going on. And it took a lot of time of almost obsessing over the numbers and trying to figure it out and trying to figure out really how I was wrong, essentially. And I found that's been a common experience amongst many of the colleagues that have come together, is that they just couldn't get it right in their own heads, and they were doubting themselves in a sense, because there was an avalanche of information that would come through the hospitals and the health bureaucracies, et cetera, that made you think that, I must be a bit crazy. I'm missing something.
And it
took several months. And I think Australians, pride themselves on being a bit stoic in that sort of English tradition. And we were sort of willing to sort of put up with things. But then it just became really quite extraordinary and ridiculous. And I think this was around August, September. And a small group of us, senior medical people around Melbourne, got together and wrote a letter to the Premier saying that the lockdowns were causing more harm than the virus ever could. That was really our main concern at that time. The lockdowns were causing enormous suffering, and both mentally, physically, because of the impact on all the other conditions that were being experienced. There were delays in, surgery and all kinds of, every other medical condition was basically put on the back burner, and was people were being delayed in their cancer diagnoses and ischemic heart disease presentations, and all sorts of things were building up and occurring. And the evidence for that was clear. And we argued that the response therefore was disproportionate to the threat, and that it was going against international conventions and the Syracuse principles. And we wrote that to our premier. We never got a response, but the media took it up, and a lot of doctors and a lot of public support came with it. And then we felt a responsibility to sort of continue to sort of question, the authorities, and it's sort of gone on from there in a very sort of, we're medical doctors. We're not specialists at activism and engaging in politics and policy, but we've been given an enormous amount of support, and we've been very grateful for that. So that's how it started, and we've continued to question the authorities' decisions on these things, and then it expands beyond the issue of lockdowns to many other aspects, which I'm sure you're familiar with. Most of them, what we would consider to be lacking in good scientific evidence, and going against the time-honored approach for public health that has been absolutely standard and accepted up until the end of 2019, and then basically thrown out the window. So we're trying to sort of inform people, mostly to also decrease the level of fear and anxiety in the community, because we think it's gotten to a level of hysteria that is very concerning, and almost to the point where arguing reason and facts and evidence doesn't seem to be sufficient to overcome the passion and the anxiety in the community. So sorry, that's a long introduction, but
no, that's good. we just learned 3 days ago, April 15th, 2021, that our Federal Trade Commission has now, under a new regulation, brought an attack on, that could be a costly fine on, a chiropractor who is selling vitamin C and vitamin D and making claims about their protective values against COVID-19. And they're trying to make an example of him. There's a long history in America of federal agencies, trying to control what they think are quacks in one way or another. And it hasn't protected the people very much. It's protected the industries much more than the people that are selling the high-priced medication. But worse than that, we've had a real crackdown here on doctors proposing and defending medical treatments, like hydroxychloroquine. Has that been going on very directly? I mean, threats against doctors, actions against doctors who use some of the oldest and most tried and true antiviral treatments?
Yeah, absolutely. We've had a very direct experience of that. We've also been very fortunate in being able to liaise with many of the American doctors who are pretty much leading the way in terms of early treatments. And I refer to Professor Peter McCulloch, who you would know, and Zelenko, and Dr. Farid, and I think Dr. Tyson as well. So we've actually been in contact with them and interviewed them, and we've actually presented them to our politicians and to our health bureaucracies to give their evidence, to say that the position currently by what we call the TGA, which is equivalent to your FDA, I suppose, it's the Therapeutic Goods Administration, it addition, based upon there's a national clinical evidence COVID task force recommendation group, who to this day say that there's not enough evidence that they shouldn't be using it, and this is certainly enforced by the authorities. I'll give you the example is that we have a website and it's called the COVID Medical Network, and that's basically
it's a very good website, COVIDmedicalnetwork.com, folks, just like in America, and you'll get there.
Yeah.
So,
and we've been very fortunate to have the assistance of some very good website builders who've built a very secure thing, and we were hoping to have at least a sort of a citadel of information there. We actually received a very threatening letter from the TGA, the Therapeutic Goods Administration, saying that we had to immediately take down a section which was called early treatments, or the evidence behind early treatments, which basically presented the evidence from all around the world that we believe the TGA was and the Clinical Evidence Task Force were not taking seriously enough, and we put criticisms of the papers that they were relying upon. And it's really quite simple that, the papers that they were using to say that these treatments were discredited were either given without zinc, given too late, given to the wrong, demographic and population. For that, we got a letter saying, we had to cease, take down that website, take down our references to Facebook immediately, or we would be fined. So we did that. We've engaged in letter writing to the TGA to clarify what exactly it is that we can and can't do in terms of talking about this, medical subject. We actually set ourselves up as a company limited by guarantee in order to sort of be able to put this information out there and not be at risk in a sense. But I suppose we still are, to some extent. We don't really know the legal implications of it, but we are, in a sense, concerned that we may be at risk, even though we are basically presenting scientific papers talking about the evidence behind, for example, Dr. Tess Lowry, who you may know, who's been out of the South Africa in the UK, presenting the evidence that she has about some of the early treatments. So they're saying basically that the accusation was that we were engaged in advertising and promotion of a medication that had not been accepted by the TGA, similar to your chiropractor, I imagine. And it is quite concerning. The fines can be quite significant. There's another doctor who went through a similar thing to that, something to do with vitamin D and vitamin C as well. And she was threatened with fines of, over $1 million. So it really was, significant. Financial impact of this. So we certainly know what that is like, we're doing what we can. We haven't heard back. We've actually asked very specific questions. Is the discussion of medical, papers now considered to be illegal and a form of advertising? We haven't heard back. We'd really like to know what is acceptable to do in terms of discussion amongst, health professionals and medical colleagues. But they're outlawing this. And the heavy-handedness of coming down on early treatments seems extraordinary. And it seems to be very orchestrated and organized around the world. What we're experiencing in Australia
is worldwide
in the US. And, I'm not... So this is the problem. I still haven't quite got my head around how orchestrated this appears to be, because I think we've been trained for a very long time as medical professionals not to sort of, wade into the potential what they call conspiracy theories. How can these things be organized in this such a capacity? But I think the scales are sort of falling from people's eyes, and they're recognizing the extraordinary simultaneous similarities across countries, particularly Anglophone countries, and that it appears to be possible to do this. For what reasons and motivations, that becomes a sort of a matter of speculation. But it is interesting that I know your vaccine rollout is based upon the EUA, the Emergency Use Authorities, and that's based upon the fact that there is nothing else. There's no treatment recognition. And it seems that if that were, that the whole thing would fall down. And it seems to me a plausible explanation for you know, the extraordinarily heavy-handed approach to the banning of cheap, as you say, reliable, safe therapies for this. You know, you'd think that they'd be celebrating and, you know, singing hallelujah for the possible numbers that are coming through on the stats, but it doesn't seem to be. So it's very puzzling.
My wife Ginger and I, we have a book coming out called COVID-19 and the Global Predators, which attempts to answer this bizarre situation to its roots. I'll give one little brief ad for the book, which is that it's available pre-publication now, folks, if you sign up for it. But you'll instantly get, and this is, I don't know any other authors that have ever done this, you'll instantly get the working manuscript, because I don't want people waiting for all the data we have. So if you sign up now, let's say tonight, within a minute in your mailbox, you're going to get this huge 400 plus pages manuscript and 800 citations, and you'll get a really low price on the book when it comes out in June, we're thinking right now. But one of the things I most recently found, which has brought us to make a very quick additions to the book and the chronology and the history, 2017 in America is a very critical year for the world, as it turns out. Really, and we can go back to 2015. In 2015, an edict from the President of the United States, Barack Obama, in 2014, Fauci continued with, and also Collins, Fauci is our head of our National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, and he's sort of the czar. He was the czar over the AIDS, the entire AIDS controversy, and behaved in a similarly criminal fashion, I believe. But under Fauci at his NIAID, but also NIH's Collins, and that's the NIH is an overview institute of about 27 other institutes, of which Fauci's is one. They were funding what's called gain-of-function research to produce more virulent and infectious viruses than found in nature. And in particularly in December 15, they published a paper saying that they had now taken a normal bat virus and turned it into a pandemic coronavirus. And they gave it some characteristics. It was a SARS-CoV virus that is producing that syndrome of disastrous inflammation of the lungs. And they were doing it with the Wuhan Institute, with Chinese, that is means communist, researchers who were working back and forth with them, particularly right there on the spike that's so critical to its having entry into the cell of the human being. And they accomplished it. They got it finally to infect the epithelial cells of human lung and living mice at the same time. And they got some hope of a vaccine out of this. One of their vaccines actually ended up being worse than nothing, because the mice who got it, who were older, died if they got COVID. So I think it set them up for probably a cytokine storm or something along those lines from being vaccinated. But they got some hope, they said. And they did this in the face of, and even discussed that, gee, maybe this isn't fit with, they didn't say President Obama, but with the current restrictions and debates. So that is December 2015. In January 1, 2017, the Congress passes legislation for the act you mentioned, the Emergency Use Authority, it's called, whereby the federal government could finance particularly vaccine companies to produce emergency vaccines at a rapid speed, bypass the FDA usual rules and regulations, and at the same time, they could only do it if there were no, as you pointed out, and very few people in America know what you said a few minutes ago, but they couldn't do it if there was a safe and effective treatment or vaccine already available. So they had to kill off ivermectin and kill off hydroxychloroquine, kill off the combinations that make them work with additional antibiotics and vitamin C and vitamin D, and especially zinc. So we got a situation in America where they just have destroyed all alternative treatments to fatten the billionaires. So also I believe cramp down on democracies, patriotic democracies like Australia and the US. We're really a democratic republic. You probably are nearer to that than a democracy too. So this is all, I'm still in January 2015. So then later in January, around the 14th, and then again 24th, Bill Gates speaks at conferences run by a man named Schwab, Klaus Schwab. Schwab is the founder of the whole concept that has now led to the Great Reset, which is it's really a combination of progressive predatorism, capitalistic predators, and top-down government people all wanting to take over big chunks of the world. And they don't have the usual progressive or conservative and those kind of parties. These are kind of predators that don't identify with anything. And I go into great detail in who they are in the book. Most of America's top billionaires, most of America's top corporations, many people identify. So Gates comes out and says, he doesn't say, hey, I've just got my get home card free, which is the new authorization from Congress that the FDA announces on the 1st of January. But he says, we have been working now for a while with Moderna. Very specifically, he mentions Moderna and other pharmaceutical people to create a novel vaccine, and it will be an RNA vaccine. He doesn't say mRNA, it's a little early for the technical language. But he's clearly talking about a coronavirus. And I have one time he's talking with a friendly group of people who, it's like a press conference of your buddy press guys. And one of them says, and a DNA too, right? DNA. And they laugh and giggle and say, well, I don't know. You guys know too much or something. It's kind of fun. But I don't know that they have certainly not tried to sell yet a specifically DNA, but they're doing the RNA viruses. So he's clearly talking about, he's expecting an imminent attack from a COVID virus. And he is enlisted in a new foundation he calls SETI. This is all going to be in the book. Billionaires coming together to set up these rush platforms. So he's basically, set up the whole, what we thought was invented by Trump and Fauci, the whole program of Operation Warp Speed in 2017. Then to cap it off, and this is a little long, at the end of 2017, John Hopkins, which will do something more famous later on, puts out a booklet in which they talk about the coming SPARS, I think they call it, SPARS, S-P-A-R-S, epidemic. And then in the context, they talk about a COVID vaccine, and then they talk about the coronavirus. And they talk about how all the corporations have to get together in this kind of what I call a corporate government fusion. And this comes out in October. So in 2017, the billionaires of the world, led by Bill Gates and led by Klaus, who's not a billionaire, he's a rich man, he's not a multi-billionaire, by Klaus Schwab. So they were setting up for this whole thing in 2017. And then the more famous is Johns Hopkins in October 2019, before the... the outbreak just by a month or two, maybe before they first start showing up in November, and certainly 2 or 3 months before January, they come out and they do a war game. And people don't know, and one of the key actors in this war game was the head of the Chinese CDC. And then we had people from our private sector and people from our government and even some of the government's more shady aspects. And it was funded again, which people don't necessarily realize, not just by Johns Hopkins, which is their center is the Bloomberg Public Health Center. Bloomberg School of Public Health. Bloomberg is another one of what I call the global predators. So they've got all these, got these three guys there, and they've got the Hopkins, and they actually do a war game with a coronavirus. Now, that's the one people mostly know about. They don't know that this was just coming later. And then in January, just before the virus comes out, and this one we just found, the Hopkins people publish a paper in a epidemiology journal, 30 some odd page monograph on how they're going to shut down the opposition to the vaccines when they come about. So these guys were planning. We are up against a terrible worldwide plan, but it's not just to make billions of dollars. It's a lot about power. And the part of it that I found most distressing, most disturbing, most freakish, and that I did the most unusual work on because I just couldn't understand it, was that every place I look, these predators were affiliated with the Communist Chinese. And that began when I realized Fauci was funding them. He was funding not only the Wuhan Institute, not only collaborative studies with North Carolina and the Wuhan Institute, he was funding the Wuhan Institute itself. And he did that during and after the moratorium. And then they themselves, after Trump's been in for a year, they personally announced at NIH that the moratorium put on by President Obama is over. They just announced it. He put it on his own stationery. They just announced it. So there's this massive thing going on. And then if you look at Gates, big investments in China. You look at Schwab, he invites the head of China, Xi Jinping, to speak at his conferences against Trump's America First stuff. Then you look at Bloomberg. He holds a big conference in Beijing during Trump. Well, I could go on forever, and I'm going to stop. No, but I could not avoid the temptation of you saying, but I don't get, and I don't know why it's been my job to get this. Yeah. Probably because I started out confronting the pharmaceutical industry and particularly heavily in the early 90s, because I was the assigned to be the medical expert scientist for all of the cases against Eli Lilly on Prozac. And I ran into such evil in the promotion of Prozac. I mean, my wife and I, our heads were spinning. I mean, and they literally fixed the biggest trial. And the fix was put on. They won. Then the court found out, canceled their victory, but the press never covered the cancellation. The whole world thought Prozac was great and exonerated.
It's interesting, Peter, that much of what you say is actually quite well known to some extent that it's available. And what also surprises me is that, as you say, it's not particularly well hidden. Particularly, you mentioned...
No, you can find it. Nobody's putting it... no one yet, as far as I know, has put it together.
No, I'm not saying that. But astounds me, for example, you mentioned the Event 201, which was the war game in New York.
Yeah, that was well known, yeah.
Yeah. But what's interesting is that it's still available on the website. But if you mention it to people, unless they sort of assume that it sounds like a conspiracy theory, and you go, no, it was actually, well, it wasn't just Bloomberg. It was the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, as well as
Gates
supported that. Yeah.
Yes.
But what's interesting from an Australian perspective is that the person who participated as one of the actors in that was Jane Halton. And she was one of the sort of very senior super bureaucrats in both the health.
In Australia.
In Australia, yeah.
Yeah.
So the connections are really quite significant. She had a very long, public service history going back to, I think she first came over. It's interesting, the links with, as you say, other countries. But she was had a health background, a finance background, and is more recently into the aging sector of bureaucracy. And she is basically one of the leaders of the National Council on how to manage the COVID. And I say to people, it's extraordinary that they were so prescient and so clever that they were able to sort of get together.
Figure it all out for it, huh?
I mean, it's great that we have such leaders on top of the situation, you know, that they were able to almost have a crystal ball. So we're very grateful for that. And so we were very linked into that particular event. The other thing that's interesting that I'm sure you're following up is the relationship between sure Gates and CCP, but also in relation to the World Health Organization. I think that what's interesting is what happened in January of last year with and the lead up to it with Tedros taking over the head of it as really a sort of, you know, he'd been sort of parachuted in, it seems, first non-medical doctor to head the World Health Organization. But when Wuhan and the Chinese were responding in January in 2020, the head of the World Health Organization in Wuhan, in China, was actually quite critical of the response. But he was quickly replaced, and then suddenly the whole world fell in step, saying, "Oh, no, this is a great idea. So lockdown everything and let's." How that kicked off is very interesting. And the other thing that I'd like to ask your question about this, it kind of confuses me, that this sort of has been going on for quite some time. You can go back to the sort of lockstep thing of the Rockefellers in 2010 as well, where they were talking about the pandemic and the virus and things.
Yes.
But this was all sort of coming to a head under the Trump administration. And one of the more interesting, if you can Google his speech in, I think it's January the 21st, 2020, where Trump gives a speech at Davos. And it's almost the next day that the whole thing just sort of unravels and sort of runs down, because it's almost like he's speaking to another world when he's talking about the achievements that he has, had in terms of economics and this and that over the previous 3 to 4 years. But this is all happening under his watch. I find that fascinating.
Well, he brings them out. He brings the rats out. He's the exterminator.
Sure.
And by the way, I left out one of the pieces that you may have heard about or not, but it is such a big deal and it has not been widely known. And that is, and it fits with this, 10 days before Trump's inauguration, Fauci is the keynote speaker at Georgetown University on preventing upcoming epidemics. And Fauci is on video saying in several different ways that he is certain Trump will have an epidemic to deal with. Certain. And he talks about the interlocking stuff that he's going to use. He's going to work with the corporations and work with the government. He's got it all planned. So this thing was building for so much longer. And people did get focused on, the conference that was held at Johns Hopkins, because that was that was so obvious. But this has been going, this has been a plan, and it's really a two-edged. It's about top-down control over humanity and these exploiters of humanity is kind of the way I look at it. It's interesting. I don't think I got to talk about it. I started to mention it, but we just had a huge conference here in America, 4,000 people almost spontaneously, with only a couple of weeks notice, met in Idaho and at a church on a biblical university. It was the only place that would let them come. And they met without masks. They didn't do any distancing. And they had a huge conference. A couple of generals were there. Some of the conservatives were there. And we are starting to have a real uprising of people standing up for liberty in the country. When you read when you read all of the materials by all these people They never talk about liberty. They never think of liberty as the engine of progress. Government control is their engine of progress. Communism, Marxism is their engine of progress. And they're all against the Judeo-Christian tradition. They all hate patriotism because all those things, all those authorities stand in the way of globalism. The globalists don't have patriotic identifications, except for probably the communists. They also have an empire in mind. They don't have a particular focus on their own group, their own nation. They don't think in terms of values higher than themselves, than relativity, than relative values. And they're all making a ton of money with business in China. It's quite astonishing. Wow. Where do you want to take it from here? I'm interested in hearing.
I'd like to ask what you think about whether, did Trump drive them so crazy that they came out too early, too fast, that this was actually intended a bit, and as a result, it's actually become more clear and obvious what's sort of been going on, and there's still communication, like, you know, around the world there's international people that sort of are putting this together a lot quicker than they expected. There are sort of court cases against things like the PCR tests in Vienna and in Portugal.
Yes.
There's people like Rainer Fulamich running cases in Canada and America and in Europe, challenging the very core of this, you know, house of cards. It seems to be out in the open and people are aware of this, or is it too late? Is there too much influence and power that they have? Or is the fact that you and others are aware that there's of the realities of it, the result of them perhaps making mistakes and going too early? And was this a result, as you say, of Trump sort of, what did he call it? Draining the swamp so that people could see what was going on.
Yeah, I think there's something. Just a comment on Trump that I think people have failed to see. Trump came out of an experience which just didn't have the kind of evil in it that full-blown politics does. And he stepped into the government without a deep sense of the evil he was facing, that everybody in the FBI would turn on him. Nobody expected that. I didn't. Everybody in the CDC, everybody in the FDA. He didn't have a sense of how deeply all these people were tied to progressivism, to top-down government, and how many of them have ties to the communists, even in the Senate and the Congress. So I think he didn't have any idea. And then these politicians, they ridiculed Trump. They had no idea he had so much power base. See, they don't know about people like me. I was erased from our major television decades ago for taking on the drug companies. And then in the midst of bestsellers, I couldn't get a book published. So literally. And so I had to learn way ahead of time to get the small publishers. We even self-published one of my 20 books. Ginger and I self-published it. But they had no idea that there was a whole group of intellectuals, including many African-Americans, who actually had a concept that was similar to the founders, that the function of government was to protect our liberty and to protect our nation. And their ideas are very opposite of that. I mean, they want open borders, which will obliterate the nation, just obliterate it. They don't want patriotism. They don't want any of the stuff that went along, a moral society that constantly breaking down on morals. You know, they don't want what the founders stood for. And they had no anticipation that there were so many of us. So they rig an election in which the president gets more votes than he did previously, which has always meant the president won. And yet out of nowhere, a man who doesn't come out of his basement gets even more votes than the president, who gets more than he did previously. They never anticipate. So they literally had to start doing this stuff, fixing. And then they had to do things like cut Trump off of Twitter and YouTube and all the other things. I mean, when I saw that YouTube could censor the president, I knew we were turning a huge corner, that they were loosening all the cannons now, because they saw that Trump actually had a huge base, more than half of America, and that we didn't weren't represented so well in Congress. We weren't at all in any of the major networks. We couldn't get our books sold in New York, but they were huge. And now what some of us are doing, like myself, is we're really focusing on building an alternative base in America. Alternative booksellers, book publishers, alternatives to Twitter and to YouTube, and doing participating in the legal battles I'm involved now just as of today. Tom Renz came to me with a new case of the government oppressing the freedom of speech of a healthcare provider. They weren't expected for how powerful we were. But when we spoke up, we weren't in any way aware of how violent and the progressives had come. Now, in America, the globalists tend to be progressive, but internationally, a lot of them pretend to be capitalists. It doesn't matter anymore, I think, is what's happened. And so I appeal to America's liberals. Hey, you got a bigger stake in this as we do, who have become conservatives. I used to be very progressive. We all who believe in individual freedom, and even if you don't believe in God, as a lot of us do. I was also an agnostic. I sort of came from a very, I came from as radical as a young man could be almost. Neither side knew how big the other was, I think. It's been flabbergasted to us to see, well, especially that they could actually strip Trump like he was a nobody of his personal rights in the media in order to do the attack on him. And that then they could make him the first president ever to be impeached when he was out of office. And impeach him twice. I mean, this is like bizarre. This is third world country. America's heading toward third world country. Australia will get a different idea, and then America and Australia can take on the world. But it looks like Canada is going more and more down, and Australia is so economically tied to China, you're in a vulnerable place. I mean, it's just not good. China's been very clever about making people vulnerable to them.
Yeah.
That's my say.
It's interesting, a lot of the Chinese expat medical colleagues that I have, they used to surprise many of their other medical colleagues, Australians, by saying, being very pro-Trump and saying he's probably the only sort of politician on the international stage capable of staring down the Chinese and Xi Jinping.
Yes.
And when people would say that, this is coming from Chinese, the Australians couldn't believe it, So it's very interesting. I think people are very quite naive about the larger sort of geopolitical movements, particularly in healthcare.
I had no idea that there were at least a dozen good books. Now China's taken over the world gradually, economically, secretly, through our educational system. I had no idea all those books were there.
There's a few intellectuals in Australia who do write books and push point this out. But as you say, it's quite difficult to get into the mainstream awareness. I think particularly health professionals, had the wool pulled over their eyes on many aspects. And I think it's really quite important for them to do that, because I think, if you're going to run this, healthcare, what people would describe as medical tyranny, it's the best way to do it, I think. I think healthcare and health is really ideally placed to achieve those ends. You need to have on board the doctors and the healthcare system. And I think they've worked very hard to sort of achieve that. And so, even to this day, like a week or so ago, we get letters from our national regulator warning every doctor not to say a word against things, or they will lose their license. So we've had lawyers in the last week who have been leading the charge on bringing the government to account through what do they call them? Those cases, class actions. lose their license. Just receive a letter in the last week, license revoked, no explanation given, because the class action, the national class action, was growing to such an extent that it must have been, you know, disturbing or quite threatening, and lost the ability to practice literally overnight with one letter. So there's an enormous amount of influence and pressure being put on the professional classes, particularly I think, you know, the health professionals, the doctors. So it's an interesting, you know, experience. But we, fortunately, we have this phenomenon of the internet where we're able to communicate with people around the world. It's really quite a blessing. And we've been able to get a lot of sustenance from speaking to the American doctors in particular. The AAPS people are quite amazing. I think, you know, that's an organization seemed to be set up for this kind of thing. And I think there needs to be something similar set up in Australia. And we really take inspiration from what's happening around the world, and being able to connect and communicate. It's been wonderful. So it's great to be, you know, to be able to even speak to yourself, Peter, and know, like, it was through that, I think, Google Doctors group that I saw that you were having writing that book. And I thought, wow, this would be a great book to access and to read for my own edification, to sort of give that information to doctors here in Australia. And yeah, I just signed up for it. And you wrote back and said, would you like to come on and have a chat? So it was really quite extraordinary. So
that was led by my wife. God bless her. She's my eyes and ears in the world. And she spotted you and brought you to me.
Yeah, no, it was really nice of her. Yeah. So I know what you mean. My wife is also the eyes and ears of, she seems to keep track of this stuff and send it on to me to read, you know, about what's going on. And luckily, by being in contact with people like yourself and others, there's some people that I think, particularly on the political Chinese sort of side of things, there's some people in Australia that you should probably have a chat to, would have some very interesting insights to about what's going on here and also around the world. And there's a particular health economics bureaucrat who quit in protest and has written a book about it called the Great Hysteria and the Failed State, I think, as a, due to his experience of what happened in Victoria. Want to know what happened? It's a great book, and he would be an interesting person to chat to about all of this. He sort of joined the dots and spent the last year pretty much joining the dots, similar to what you have done. Yeah.
Well, we've been finding the same resources. One you didn't mention is the Epoch Times. It's spelled E-P-O-C-H, but Epoch, it helps people understand the spelling. And it's funded by Chinese dissidents who came to America. And that's, again, because they know what's going on in China. And we're seeing it here. And the Chinese are very busy reinforcing all these tech companies, strengthening them, even manning some of their you know, committees that are doing the censoring, from what I've heard. I can't track that one exactly, but it's one of the things. Can you tell us some more about just how bad, I want people here, just how bad it got for a time in your city? I understand it was like a ghost town, and who did it, and how much free of it have you gotten?
Well, it's interesting. Well, it is become a little bit freer. And it's interesting why that is. I'm not sure, but I can get, there's some, been some interesting occurrences. So to give you a picture, we've had approximately 26,000. I can get the exact number up for you. Just one second. We've had 29,469 cases, right? So what we mean by cases is all very unclear. There's actually a document put up by the government, which is an entire page defining what a case is. And there's lots of ors. There's not and or, there's not ands, there's lots of ors. And it starts with a positive PCR test. And as you know, that's one of the sort of probably eight legs of this whole phenomenon that needs to be sort of questioned and exposed, and Rainer Fulamich is doing a great job on this. So less than 30,000 cases in a population of 25 million. So even if you take those PCRs as being real and indicating an infection, which they don't, and in fact, our own government, our Department of Health and Human Services, as well as our Department of Health, have acknowledged that the test does not indicate infectiousness, right? And yet we've been closing down borders and states based upon a single case, single cases of a positive PCR test. Now, there are other definitions to that, but most of them are, it's interesting that it says or. They can be historical cases due to associations, epidemiological, but there's a very large net that catches what constitutes a case. So what
and
that means...
People need to know, that's not how we doctors think. A case of somebody you know is sick.
We spoke to many journalists and we said, why don't you just ask the Premier? The Premier used to, in our state, a man called Daniel Andrews, used to give an hour-long presentation on television live every day at 11 o'clock for an hour, where he would talk about the numbers and the cases and just basically mesmerize people on the cases that have been discovered and things. So, and I said to the journalist, why don't you ask them, what do you mean by a case? What does that actually even mean? But it was interesting, the terminology of cases. As you say, it's not something that's familiar with doctors. Doctors were wondering, what the heck does this mean? So out of that less than 30,000 cases, there's been 910 deaths. Okay, so we're in a part of the world where the numbers, deaths per million due to this SARS-CoV-2 is around the 30 per million. Whereas in the United States and Europe, you're up around 1,600 per million. So it's a fraction of what, even if we take those deaths to be what they are and true, because this is the other aspect to it, of those 910 deaths, like less than 1,000. This is what's very strange, is the extreme smallness of this reality in contrast to the significant lockdowns that we've experienced, because it's like two ends of the spectrum. So of those 910 deaths, most of them happened in the state of Victoria, I think over 800. So we're the sort of, you know, second largest state. So it all happened in our state. 80% of them happened in nursing homes or in aged care settings.
80%.
Right? I can show, at the end, if you'd like, I can give you the graphs of this. This is coming straight out of the Department of Health's government website.
Is there a way for you to flash it up on our screen and maybe obliterate me or you?
On Skype.
But don't destroy our communications.
Yeah. But it's quite, so of the 910, so most of them happened in Victoria. So this is the other question that's happened here as well, is that they've changed the definitions at the level of the Australian Bureau of Statistics to conflate the issues of dying with or dying of COVID. So this has happened in the UK and other places. If you happen to have a positive PCR test, which is also questionable, and you die within 28 days of that, in the UK, for example, you are considered a COVID death statistic. Similar thing has happened in Australia. We think we have the opportunity to actually go through, it's less than 1,000 death cases, if we were organized enough, to actually go through each one of those, just like happened in Ireland with Professor Cahill, to actually examine each of those. Because we have...
All right, RCD is... Oh, God, our blessed organization in charge of epidemiology has, CDC has refused to review the cases. It says on an eyeballing, none of the 2,500 so far deaths from vaccines, for example, have been examined. And similarly, they've never examined the cases of deaths from the COVID. So what I'm importantly to point out to people is they're inflating wildly the deaths from the COVID and deflating the deaths from the vaccine. Again, it's to make billions of dollars and is to weaken the Western nations. The countries like Australia, with a tradition of freedom and liberty and individualism, and America, we are the bastions against these people, and they got us running.
Mm. And so just to give you just another couple of numbers, we've, in a country of 25 million, we've actually done 16,264,597 PCR tests. So they're testing everybody. What's interesting is out of that number, there's only been 0.2% positive. So when we talk just even in terms of statistics of false positives, a 0.2% positive finding to create that 30,000 cases is fundamentally flawed. Not even looking at the actual test itself and the problems inherent with that in terms of indicators of infectivity. But that's the trigger to cause lockdowns of states. So we've been in, the second longest continuous and cumulative lockdown in the world. I think Venezuela might be ahead of us. But this is with one of the lowest case numbers and deaths in the world. So they introduced 8 p.m. curfews. Like in a modern democracy, you had to be in your home. You could not go out at night. Fortunately, because I'm an obstetric anaesthetist, I had a pass that allowed me to go out. And it was interesting to go through the night at 9 o'clock at night through a city of 6 million. We have a 6 million population. It's a very large city. So we would be the third largest city in Europe, for example. So we're not a little sort of, back of the woods town. So to close down a population, an entire state, which is about 7 million, but a city which is close to 6 million people, where the people could not go out after 8 p.m. at night. We thought that there was no evidence for this, that this would, and in fact, cases were brought to the Supreme High Court here in Victoria to say that the grounds for this were unacceptable or disproportionate. And we asked for the evidence upon which this evidence, this decision was made. The big problem, I think, is the lack of transparency. And so we've had opposition governments pushing since July last year to simply get the briefs, the evidence behind which the government has made decisions. And it has been stonewalled. For a liberal democracy in which its own pandemic response talks about openness with the community, explaining the evidence, etc., has been completely shut down. So people are, we don't even know as doctors why the decisions were made. We're looking at all the evidence on the masks, on the shutdowns, on the lockdowns and things, and we can't see the evidence for it. It goes against all of the recommendations of what they call the non-pharmaceutical interventions of the World Health Organization up until 2019. All of the activities that they've done seem to go against this. And yet no evidence is brought forth to the public or to the opposition governments to explain this. And this is the real tyranny, I think, that has been exercised. Decisions by, edicts put out, no basis in science or medicine, and not even the willingness to show the reasons behind this. This has been really quite disturbing. So mandatory masks, curfews, no businesses allowed to function. But also, it's not just that no businesses, and this is, I think, gives a clue to it. One of the decisions was that no one could, for example, exercise their business, and it was mostly small business, so small business operators. So there was a particular man called Jim Penman who runs a thing called Jim's Mowing, and it's a franchise of local lawn mowers and gardeners, right? And there's teams of them, it's very well known. And they're all sort of, young men, families who do gardening around the state and around the city. They weren't allowed to operate, but teams of council gardeners were. So the arbitrariness, the unjust arbitrariness of the decisions was also something that made, people sort of say, what the heck is going on? But the power of the media was sufficient that there wasn't enough. It didn't seem to have an impact enough for the greater population to sort of go, wait a minute, right, we're not going to do this.
So we've got to finish up about now.
Sorry.
No. I talk much more than I usually do. You're doing fine. You're teaching me something that I just think could be so helpful to everybody listening. The size of the oppression, the size of the COVID-19 crackdown is not proportional to the size of the actual risk to the people. The size of the COVID-9 crackdown is proportional to what they can get away with. And so this is like a formula that I haven't had until today, because I didn't understand the dynamics in Australia. Thank God, goodness you agreed to come on, because the big lesson is that, folks, that COVID-19 is a sham. Because even if our data was fractional compared to what's going on in Australia, they'd still be hammering us. Because here's Australia with so few deaths and so few illnesses. And the crackdown's worse than ours because they could get away with it more for whatever reason in Melbourne and in Victoria. So that's a huge lesson. Send me the graph you wanted to put up. And if we can't get it into the video, folks, we will have it as a splash page at the end and you can stop and look at it for a while. Dr. Matheson, thank you. I hope that you will feel free to get in touch with us at some point and say, you know, you've got some things you really want to share again. I agree with you that we need to be communicating between Australia and the United States, and we need to be prepared to join your military in defending you if it comes down to that, because a lot of this, folks, goes back to the Chinese. And the Chinese have deep teeth into Australia's economy right now and deep teeth into ours.
Yeah. I think, Peter, I was just going to explain perhaps why Victoria was in particular so egregious in its response. We've actually, our government did sign up a deal with the Chinese in the sort of Belt and Road Initiative against the sort of national imperative. And which stood out, this was a couple of years ago. So the ties to China, I think, with our local state government are really quite significant and very concerning. And so people have put up that as an explanation as why in particular Victoria was...
Yeah, it makes sense.
So it ties in with your theory.
Yes, I see that. Thank you. What a pleasure to meet you.
Yeah, thank you, Peter. Thanks for having me on. Happy for the chat. It's great.
It's very, very good. Let's stay in touch. And, you know, we're just all going to stand up for freedom as best we can. We're planning to make a real fight of it here in America. There's just a lot of us who feel we have to stand up for liberty. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for your insights. Thank you. Eamon Matheson, thank you so much. Bye-bye now. Mm-hmm.